This is Jock Talk, an intimate, in-depth discussion with the best jockeys in thoroughbred racing. Presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
25-year-old Mario Gutierrez, who touched Derby, 1:38.
Digging down for the final 16th under Victor Espinosa.
Joe Calamo in the ride of his life, in the race of his life.
Gary Stevens, 3 Preaknesses.
A brilliant ride by Calvin Burrell.
Up the inside under Johnny Velasquez to take it.
Shanghai Bobby and Rosina Pravnik come again to beat. He's had enough.
Raji Barrage aboard, crushing the field here.
Perfectly ridden by Javier Castellano.
A scintillating performance under Rafael Bejarano.
Now, here's Christina McManigal.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka, here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. I am Christina McManigal, once again flying solo on today's show. Mike Penna should be back with us next week. I am in our Lexington, Kentucky studios, and I want to extend a special welcome to everyone joining us throughout North America on Sirius 220 XM 206, and everyone listening live via our website, horseracingradio.net, everyone around the world. And so this year, so far on Jock Talk, we have had the honor of speaking with such great riders, past and present, who possess such talent, such personality. This evening, I feel like everyone listening, myself included, will walk away from this show feeling inspired and in awe of the determination and strength of our guest, whom I will now introduce you to. With 2,137 wins, over $19 million in earnings, a breast cancer survivor, and in fact, the third all-time leading female jockey in the history of thoroughbred racing, I am very proud to introduce to you PJ Cooksey.
Ta-da! Drum roll! Ta-da! Yeah. Hi, Christina.
Hi, PJ. How are you?
Doing wonderful. We've got some beautiful sunshine here in Kentucky, and it just feels so good. Spring is here.
It does. We had a rough winter. It's good to have the sun shining.
Yeah, it feels good.
Yes,
feels
it does.
Good.
Yes, it does. And thank you for taking the time out of your very busy day to join us here for an hour of Jock Talk. And so to kick things off, PJ, I would like you to take us back to the beginning of your story in Youngstown, Ohio. What kind of a girl were you growing up, and how were horses introduced to your life?
Wow, Youngstown, Ohio. I haven't heard that word in a long time. Well, Youngstown, Ohio is the city in which I was born. And I was born into a family of 3 older brothers and a younger sister. So naturally, my younger sister is about 4 or 5 years younger than me. So there was a few years there where I was the only girl with 3 older brothers. So as all of you women out there who have grown up with older brothers, you know what kind of kid I probably was. I was a tomboy. Loved playing tackle football and baseball and running, and you know, that's all we did was just, you know, play sports outside with the boys. And you know, so I was virtually at a young age a tomboy and enjoyed sports, played sports all through high school, you know, excelled in softball, track, and actually basketball, if you can believe it, at 4'11". I was a pretty good basketball player at my time, so it was a lot of fun. I was a tomboy in my younger years.
So you're very athletic naturally.
That came with the territory. You know, you either hung out with the guys or you went and played dolls, you know. And so, you know, my athleticism, of course, came, you know, my mom was very athletic. She played ball back in her day, which was the softball. And, you know, my father was a track star. So, you know, I was kind of bred into it, you know, to be somewhat of an athlete. But even at that age, you know, aspiring to become a jockey was the farthest thing, wasn't even a thought in my mind, which is pretty amazing that I ended up there.
It is. So did you grow up on a farm? Were you around horses your whole life, or how did that come to be?
Yeah, at a very young age, probably 3, you know how you just vaguely remember some things at an age. And then, of course, my parents would always, you know, tell the story of, you know, we lived on a farm. I think it was 20-some acres up in Ohio, and my brother had a show horse. And, you know, we rode, you know, quite a bit, was around horses. You know, and then my dad had some standardbreds that he raced at the county fairs in Ohio. So I kind of hung out the barn, you know, with him with the horses and everything. And just at a very early young age, I developed a massive passion for, you know, the horses. And, you know, was off and on, you know, up until probably age about 11, you know, going to the barn sometimes and, you know, doing all those other things that kids do. And every year, here was the phone, every year our family vacation was at what's called the Canfield Fair, which is one of the largest county fairs in the nation. And that was our vacation time. All five of us kids and mom and dad and everybody, we'd go to the fair. We camped there all week. And of course, you know, it was like, you know, $2 a day we'd have to spend all day at the fair. Well, I remember what I would do is I would go to the pony barns and I would watch the kids doing their horse shows, doing all the pony shows. And, you know, I remember just being so envious of those kids that had ponies then. At the time, we didn't have any, you know, and showing their horses and everything. And one day, that, you know, they used to have pony races in between the standardbred races at the county fair there. And they'd usually put little kids on them. Well, one day I was standing around, and this lady came up to me. She shipped in with probably, you know, a trailer full of about 8 or 9 ponies. And I was just kind of hanging around the stable there. And she said, "Do you ride?" And I, you know, stood up straight. And I said, "Yeah, of course I do," you know, that kind of thing. And she says, "Well, I need a rider for one of my ponies." I said, "Yeah, I can do that." She said, "You got a helmet?" And I kind of looked around like, no, I know I didn't have a helmet, but, you know, I told her I did, and I'd go get one. So I rustled up a helmet, those little old plastic things that were just nothing, you know. So I rustled up a helmet that was too big for me. I had to sign the paperwork. And, mom, you know, you have to get the paperwork signed that's saying that mom and dad agree that you can ride these pony races. So I went to dad first, and dad's like, "Oh, no, no way." And then finally I kept bugging him, and he said, "You go ask your mom." So I went and asked mom. I said, "Mom, dad said I can do this if it's okay with you." So, of course, you know, mom's like, "Well, you know, if dad says it's okay, then so." Anyway, I got my parents to sign the permission slip for me to ride, you know, pony races at the Canfield Fair. And that was kind of the beginning. I only rode the 2 pony races. It's bareback. And what they do is they go from a standing start where they kind of spin the ponies around. And then as soon as everybody gets kind of in a line, then they let them go. And then they go one time around a, you know, half-mile track. So that was kind of fun. But, you know, when you think back, that was kind of probably pretty stupid because I really didn't have the experience or didn't even know if I had the skill sets to be riding bareback on a pony around a racetrack. So that was kind of the start, and, you know, that was a lot of fun, and then we did all the other stuff. We went to school and went to college for, you know, a few years, and never really thought about being a jockey.
So it sounds like you started out gutsy, and it's typical. Ask your mother, of course.
Yeah.
Now, do you remember, did you win any of those pony races?
No, I didn't win any. The one that I rode, I probably, you know, I beat 2 or 3 ponies, and the helmet was too big, so the picture, I still got the picture, you know, the photographer takes a picture, and the helmet, I've got my head tilted back, and the helmet's down over my eyes. I mean, it's hilarious, because the helmet's too big, and I can't see, and here I am riding bareback. But anyway, that was the first race. The second race, the pony came out of the last turn, and he knew where the out gate was, which is up at the top of the stretch, so he kind of made a right-hand turn. And I kept just pulling and pulling, and I, you know, heck, I probably didn't weigh 45, 50 pounds at the time. And he just kind of went to the outside fence and stopped at the gate there. It kind of made me mad, but my dad said he was having a heart attack at the time. And that was pretty much the extent of it, you know. So, no, I didn't win any, and probably, like I said, should have never been on the back of those ponies at that time, but it sure was fun.
Did not finish that one there.
DNF'd.
Too funny. So you say that you went to college.
Yeah, I went to University of Akron for a couple years. I wanted to be I wanted to be a police officer, and I wanted to be a mounted police officer. That was kind of one of my goals when I went to college. And I'd gotten about a year and a half of schooling in, and, you know, when you meet with the counselors, you know, they were wanting to find out your goals and what you want to do. And I said, "Well, I want to be a mounted police officer." And she looked at me at, like I said, still 4'11". She's like, "Well, you can't be a police officer. They have a height requirement, you know." And I was way too short, you know, to be a police officer. Of course, back then, back in the 70s, you know, there was no such thing as discrimination. You know, of course, they can't do that today. But I was too short to be a cop. And, you know, so I wasn't going to make it to be a police officer. So, you know, I played basketball for a couple years at the University of Akron. I was on the women's basketball team, and I was actually the first female to make the snare drum line in the university marching band. So I played drums and played basketball, and then I said, well, I got to do something else. So that was the extent of my college experience. Never did get my full education, but I do have some college credits, and I've taken college credits off and on, you know, throughout the years, just, you know, trying to keep the brain from going to mush. Eventually I was waiting tables at a restaurant that my mother managed in Lake Milton, Ohio, and it was a Greek restaurant, and I was waiting tables, and this gentleman was in at the bar who, his son was a jockey, and he had owned ponies at the county fair also, and he recognized me. So, you know, we started talking, and, you know, he was like, that's, you know, probably something you should do. And so I packed everything that I owned into my car, which wasn't much, and I headed to West Virginia, the little track called Waterford Park. And when I arrived at Waterford Park, my gas tank was on E. I was out of money, and I slept in my car that night until his son, Jimmy Andrews, who was a jockey at Waterford, met me at the gate and took me in, and I got a job walking hots for Walter Fisher, who had just shipped up from Florida. And that was the beginning of my racetrack.
Wow. What a beginning. What a beginning. And to go back real quick, I find it fascinating. You said you were the first female to make the snare drum line. Well, that was the first of many other records that were to be broken. And so you arrived at Waterford Park, which is now Mountaineer, correct?
Correct.
Correct. So you started walking hots. And did it take a while for you to get that opportunity to get a leg up on a thoroughbred?
Well, you know, the good thing about Waterford Park is they had a system to where, you know, when somebody came onto the racetrack, you had to work 6 months. You had to have a groom's license for 6 months, and then you could get a pony license. You had to get a pony's license for 4 months before you can even apply for an exercise rider's license. You know, whereas today you have some kids coming on the track and with a helmet and saying, yeah, I can ride a thoroughbred racehorse. And it, you know, causes problems and it's pretty dangerous for everybody else. So, you know, that being said, you know, I was a groom for like a 20-horse stable, and then I became assistant trainer for that stable. And, you know, I really learned it from the ground up. And, you know, it was the best thing I could have done, you know, walking hots, then grooming, assistant trainer, being in charge of the whole outfit. And then eventually, you know, I started ponying horses in the evenings, you know, during the races. When I went for my exercise rider's license, I had to, you know, gallop a horse before the stewards. The stewards came down, and they approved you to gallop horses. So then I think I galloped horses for about 5 months before I went for my jockey's license. And I'd been, I remember galloping. When I was galloping, I loved it. I mean, here I am getting paid to get on horses and take them out on the track and ride. I'm getting paid to ride horses. It was the most awesome thing. And I'm 20, 23 years old right now. I mean, it was like great. I loved it. I loved the racetrack life. Got up at 3:30, 4 o'clock in the morning. You know, you were done by 10, and you had all day and came back and fed. And, you know, it was like the greatest life. I mean, this was awesome.
I remember thinking that same exact thing when I was galloping horses, same thing. And that's a really good process. Like you said, it's best to know the horse before you actually get up in the saddle to ride. It's like someone who drives a car. Well, it helps to know how to change the oil and certain mechanical things about the car. It helps to know. So to know how to groom a horse, how to be an assistant trainer, that had to help you a lot.
Well, absolutely. I mean, thoroughbred horses are a different breed. I mean, you could be walking and the horse walking nice and calm down the shed row with his head down. You got him all nice and relaxed, and somebody drop a bucket at the end of the shed row, and next thing you know, they're like on all fours, kicking out, you know, dragging you down the shed row. You know, so I mean, you know, it was kind of one of those, like, you know, you have to learn about the horses and, you know, a lot of their personalities and what kind of animal they are. And they're very high-spirited animals. You know, and that was probably the best thing. And I learned about injuries, and, you know, I learned a lot about, you know, how a horse felt, and, you know, maybe a horse was off a little bit. And I think that was one of the biggest lessons I learned and was able to convey to trainers that I galloped for. You know, like a horse that, you know, maybe wasn't feeling quite right, and I can kind of pinpoint it a little bit, and they'd check it out and go, wow, sure enough, it was a hawk, you know, or, you know, maybe a filly, you know, was galloping all stiff in behind, and, you know, I think I mentioned something to one trainer about it felt like up underneath, you know, her kidneys and maybe her ovaries, and, you know, when the vet checked her, you know, she'd had follicles on her ovaries, you know. So, you know, I think it taught me to become a horse person or a horseman, horsewoman, however you want to put it, being on the ground and working my way up so that I was able, like I said, to be a better horseman and have better horsemanship once I started riding races.
Most definitely, most definitely. And so you did start riding races, and actually you won your first race in 1979 with Turf Advisor.
That was a long time ago. Wow.
Yeah, you know, it's all relative. It's all relative. But do you remember that day? Do you remember how you felt?
Oh, yeah, you never forget that. I remember my first, I'll go back to my first race. I'd been galloping horses for this big outfit, J.C. Williams. He was one of the leading trainers there. It was Dale Baird and J.C. Williams. They had two of the biggest outfits. So I was getting on horses for J.C. Williams. And I'm going to go ahead and tell this story because, you know, we're serious radio and not that anything happens like this anymore. But I was galloping horses for this big outfit, and I was getting ready. I was getting ready for it to get my okay to get my jockey's license. And I had to get three horses lined up, two older riders and then myself, and we had to break from the gate. I had to have a steward there, and then I had to have, you know, the two riders with me and then the Jockeys Guild representative there in order to get my okay to, you know, to be able to ride my first race. So I remember prior to that, you know, I'm watching the race. They told me I have to watch races. They let me up in the steward stand. I'd watch, you know, from the starter stand, I'd watch races. And this one race, they broke, and I remember seeing this jock reach down. He had lost his stirrup, and he just kind of calmly reached down, you know, right after the start, flipped his stirrup back on his foot, and just went on the race as though nothing happened. And I thought, wow, that was pretty slick, you know. And I just was amazed at how he could do that, you know, when the horse is, you know, lunging out of the gate and everything. Well, sure enough, whenever I was getting ready to go for my my jockey's license and do my break, I was in between the two riders, and we left the gate. And, of course, J.C. Williams, you know, there was this horse I'd been getting on. He knew the horse was, you know, pretty quick, so he put me on that horse to make me look good. Well, he broke so hard that my iron kicked off. And so I remember, you know, I just kind of slid my hand down, found my stirrup, put my iron back on, and, you know, went on and did the breeze and everything. And I guess later the stewards were pretty impressed, and they were talking about, you know, whether or not, you know, they should give him a license. And one guy told him, they says, did you see what happened? And they were like, no, what'd she do? You know, like, I did something wrong. They said, well, she lost her stirrup. So that was kind of cool, you know. So they gave me my license, and you know, so my first race, I was supposed to ride a horse for J.C. Williams, but I got excited, and this other guy put me on a horse. And it was just a, you know, it was a low-level, kind of a 30-to-1 horse. And J.C., he got mad at me for accepting the mount, but I was so excited. And getting my jockey pants, I had to get my jockey pants, and I had to get a jockey's helmet, my boots. And, you know, it was really neat getting dressed the first time. I can remember being in the jockey room getting dressed. Well, in the starting gate, for my first race, it was a 7-furlong race on the turf, and it was like a 10-horse field. And I remember sitting in the gate. I was in about the 3 or 4 hole, and we're sitting there, and, you know, you hear all this yelling and screaming, whoa, 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 boss, whoa, whoa, hold on, hold on. You know, everybody's screaming, yelling. I'm just kind of sitting real still. And the next thing I know, the horse beside me on my right, on the outside, he flips in the gate. He turns over backwards, and all I look over and all I see is hooves just flailing in the air. And the kid that was holding my horse grabs me up out of the saddle, pulls me out of the way, and the jock goes flying out the back, and I'm like, oh, my goodness, what is happening? And finally they got the horse down on his feet, got the jock on, you know, got me back on. And I remember looking out through the bars of the starting gate, and this is my first race, thinking, what am I doing here? I was not sure if I was ready for this because that was just an amazing experience. Well, anyway, we broke out of the gate. You know, I stayed in my lane and did everything real good. And about the top of the lane, my horse was, like, last by many. He'd done stopped running, and my legs were so tired that I remember looking down on the turf thinking, if I just could just fall real easy right here, maybe I won't get hurt, because I had no legs. My legs were like rubber trying to hold myself up. So anyway, I got the horse pulled up, brought him back, and I jumped off, and my legs just collapsed underneath me. I fell back on my rear end, fell down, and I mean, it was a disaster, my first race. But you know what? I did it. I rode a thoroughbred racehorse in a race. And I remember the next morning going out, you know, the next morning to get on horses and everything, and I remember I could overhear people, you know, they were like, you know, she'll never make it. That was awful, you know. I mean, I'm like, what? But I made it. What do you mean? Yeah, I made it, my first race. So anyway, you know, that was whenever I heard people tell me that I couldn't do it and I couldn't and I'm not going to make it, that's when it really made me even more determined. And, you know, and that's when I just really worked hard. And then finally J.C. Williams put me on a horse. And I remember going to the paddock. And he looked down at me, he says, now you grab two handfuls of mane and don't you dare fall off. I'm like, yes, sir, yes, sir. So I was just going 3/4 of a mile. I grabbed two handfuls of mane, and this horse come out of there and shot out like a rocket. He opened up 3 up the backside, 6 around the turn, and ended up winning by like 10 or 12 lengths. And all I did was just sit there. So that was my first win.
Nice.
But now I'll tell the story I can tell this story years later. And Mr. Williams, you know, God rest his soul, is no longer with us. But I guess he had gotten called up to the steward's stand like the next day. And because this horse had such a reversal of form, I mean, this horse had been getting beat like double figures, you know, 18 lengths, 22 lengths, you know, 12 lengths. You know, this horse's whole form was just horrible, you know. And then he puts me on the horse, and the horse wins by 12. And so they called him in about the horse's reversal of form. You know, how'd this horse run so good, you know? And he said, well, let me tell you, gentlemen, he said, this horse just, you know, has had his problems, and he just doesn't have the best way of going. And he says, I just think that that girl was just too stupid to know that this horse was sore, and she just went ahead and let him run. So that was my first win, and, you know, it was a lot of fun. And then, as they say, the rest is history.
The rest is history. Jockey PJ Cooksey joining me on Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka on the Horse Racing Radio Network, describing those first few memories in the saddle. And PJ, what cool stories you have. I have to say, just to take us back and to describe it the way that you do, you know, we really feel like we're there. And so, as you say, the rest is history. So where did you go from Waterford?
Well, my first two full meets at Waterford Park, I was leading rider, both male and female. You know, and it helped that J.C. Williams, which was one of the top trainers, you know, was, you know, he put me on some horses and some livestock, and I started winning races. And of course, you know, here I am winning races, and I'm thinking I'm good. I'm like, hey, you know, I'm good at this. And then I started. I'd gotten enough confidence, and then I started becoming more aware of the horses I was riding. And it's really neat, Christina. I'm sure, you know, it's just an amazing thing that you can't explain is when a rider really actually becomes one with a horse. I mean, literally, mentally and physically, you become one with an animal. And sometimes you can break out of the gate and you ride a race. And a jockey during the running of the race makes so many split second decisions. You know, you're coming up to a hole and you've got to decide whether or not the horse on the inside and the horse on the outside are going to keep course, or whether or not, you know, you feel your horse on whether or not they're going to go in that hole when you put them in that position. Because if sometimes you put a horse in there and they hesitate, you know, that's when things can really go bad. And so, you know, you've got to know your horse, and you've got to know all the horses and riders around you. So you're constantly making these split-second decisions, inside, outside, let my horse run now, how much horse does that guy have? You know, he's already riding his horse. He's going to be out by the time he gets to quarter pole, you know, that kind of thing. That sometimes a race is over, I mean, as soon as it starts. And then here you are, you know, coming down the lane, you're a winner, and you're like, wow, it's just the most amazing, thrilling thing that that you can ever do, is just becoming one with the animal like that.
Give me goosebumps, PJ. Give me goosebumps. I've described it in the past as you're in the zone. You're so focused on your horse and your animal, and everything slows down. And
literally, I mean, it, you do, you just become one, and it's just, it's a zone. And I, you know, I think basketball, well, all athletes get that zone. And I mean,
yes,
to be in that, you know, so many times with horses is, especially with another living being like that, that's got a mind of its own, you know, you kind of got to let it know what you're thinking, and then you've got to be receptive enough to know what it's thinking. And, you know, it was just a wonderful thing to be that close and that intense with, you know, with another animal like that. And, well, I was leading rider, my first two full meets there, both male and female. And I thought, well, you know what, there's got to be something better than this. You know, I guess I could have stayed and been a big fish in a little pond, but you know, when you think of it as a jockey, the only place to ride was Kentucky back then. I mean, that was, you know, that was the race place and, you know, horse capital of the world, and that's where if you wanted to make it as a jockey, you make it in Kentucky. So I packed my tack and made the trip south and came to Kentucky. I arrived about 1980 at Old Latonia in up in Florence, Kentucky. And I remember I came in and, you know, the Kentucky boys, they weren't used to having a bunch of girl jockeys because there really weren't any, you know, girl jockeys that were passing through Kentucky. And, you know, when I landed, I kind of thought I'd kind of pick up where I left off. You know, I got two leading riding trophies, and, hey, you know, I'm good. But I'll tell you what, them good old boys, them hard boots, they wasn't going to have anything to do with no girl jockey. So I found it hard to really get mounts even. You know, I couldn't prove my ability if I couldn't find anything to ride. So so I was kind of really struggling and everything, and I was talking to the clerk of scales. Gosh, his name will come to me, but everybody loved him. And I was talking to him one day, and, you know, I was like, man, I'm so frustrated. Maybe I should just go back to Waterford Park and, you know, be a big fish in a little pond. I can't get started here. And he said, well, let's try something, you know. And he said, what's your middle name? And I said, Joanne. He says, well, let's try something. So when the program came out the next day, you know, instead of Patricia Cooksey on the program, I was now PJ Cooksey. And I saw that, and I was like, huh, okay. So sometimes trainers would call in, and you know, another jock would have a double call in a race, and they'd take off their horse, so they'd need a rider. Well, they'd call in, and the clerk of scales, he would tell them there's this new rider in town, and PJ Cooksey, and the trainers would say, well, fine, put him on. So I remember going to the paddock the first time as PJ Cooksey, and I walked up, and I was on the sixth horse, and I walked up to the trainer, and I put my hand out, and I said, hi there, I'm PJ Cooksey. And he put his arms up in the air, and he said, oh, my God, you're a girl. And I said, yes, sir, I've been that way for 25 years. Now, how would you like me to ride your horse? So that kind of got my foot in the door, though. You know, I mean, you know, that worked for a few times, at least a couple weeks, until I was able to get some mounts, and then, you know, did pretty well with those mounts and win a couple races, and then, you know, again, then people got to think, hey, that PJ Cooksey, that ain't no guy, that's a girl, you know. So, but it got me started here in Kentucky, and I've been here ever since, never left.
So, PJ Cooksey was born, and we'll continue our visit with jockey PJ Cooksey after this short commercial break. Stay with us. You're listening to Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Hi, I'm Tito Beveridge, founder and master distiller of Tito's Handmade Vodka, America's original craft vodka. I believe in the craft process of distilling in batches using old-fashioned pot stills, and that's the way we still make Tito's Handmade Vodka today. We even won the World Spirits Competition, double gold, unanimous judge's choice. Tito's Handmade Vodka is made from 100% corn, so it's naturally gluten-free. For recipes, videos, and more, visit Tito'sVodka.com. 80 proof Tito's Handmade Vodka, 5th Generation Inc., distilled and bottled in Austin, Texas.
Since 2006, the Permanently Disabled Jockeys Fund has provided critical financial assistance to some 60 riders who have sustained catastrophic on-track injuries. The lives of these former athletes who have given so much to the sport of horse racing have been changed forever. I'm Mike Penna, president of the Horse Racing Radio Network and proud supporter of the PDJF, and I ask you to join me in supporting this outstanding organization right now by texting the word jockey to 50555. You'll be credited with a $10 donation that can literally change the lives of those disabled riders who need it so much. It's quick, it's easy, and it's only $10. Who would think a simple $5 Exacta box would mean so much to so many? So let's all help make a huge difference in the lives of those riders who have given us so many great memories. Text the word jockey to 50555 today and visit pdjf.org to learn more. Message and data rates may apply. Terms mgive.org/chi.
Hello, this is Kayla Strah, and I'm here to tell you all about BetAmerica.com. It is the fastest growing legal, safe, and secure website to place all your bets on horse racing. BetAmerica covers over 200 racetracks from North America, the UK, and my home country, Australia. New players to BetAmerica receive a 100% bonus on your first deposit up to $300. That's the best sign-up bonus available today. It's time to play the BetAmerica way.
The New York Thoroughbred Breeding and Development Fund means business for New York. Together with all equine pursuits in the Empire State, we pay more than $187 million in taxes and provide 33,000 jobs. We provide scholarships for young people who want to join the New York horse industry, and we encourage everyone to support all thoroughbreds all their lives. Visit nybreds.com to learn more about why the fund means business.
This Saturday, HRRN brings you Grade 1 racing from around the country with the Santa Anita Derby, the Bluegrass Stakes, and the Wood Memorial. Tune in beginning at 4 p.m. Eastern as our award-winning team takes you to Santa Anita, Keeneland, and Aqueduct for live coverage of these crucial Derby preps. Go to horseracingradio.net for affiliate information and to listen live.
Hi, this is Larry Colmus, and you're listening to the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Welcome back to Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka. I'm Christina McManigle, joined tonight by jockey PJ Cooksey. PJ, welcome back.
All right, thank you.
Now we're back. We can let the stories continue. We were talking over the break. I am so mesmerized, I forget to ask questions. So.
Well, maybe if I'd shut up, you'd be able to chime in there and ask a question, huh?
No.
You're just going to have to interrupt me, Christina.
They don't want to hear me. They want to hear you. So you before we left for the break, you told us how you made the move to Kentucky. And is that now Turfway Park where you originally shipped to?
Yes, it's Turfway.
Turfway Park. And I believe you eventually did very well there.
Yes. I was leading rider at Turfway Park, and I'm not sure what years. I think I had a leading rider title in the 80s, maybe a couple, two or three in the 90s. I said I'm not sure what years, but I got a couple leading rider riding titles there. I also rode over at River Downs over in Ohio, a little track over there. I love that track. That was like the most amazing racetrack. You know, it was a great surface, the Ohio River behind that track. I just loved riding there in the summertime. So rode there a lot, you know, and then shipped around. We had a couple Ohio breds that we shipped around. You know, I kind of pretty much rode in Florida, and I went out to California, went to stakes out there, you know, New York, that type thing. So, but my base home was Kentucky, and I just kind of shipped wherever.
I believe, PJ, you were the first woman to win a $100,000 race in California. Is that right?
Yeah. That was 1983 on a horse called So Vague. We shipped out there, and he just broke his maiden at Turfway Park or Latonia, and the guy had big aspirations with this colt. You know, he's pretty high on him, and I mean, you know, he was a nice horse, but you know, I never thought he was that caliber. But he talked the owners into shipping him out there to California for the Hollywood Preview Stakes, and I remember there was, it was like a 14 or 15 horse field, and Sandy Hawley, Willie Shoemaker, Jacinto Vasquez, Georgie Velasquez, Chris McCarron, just a few of the riders that were in that race, and of course me, little country girl from Kentucky coming out to California to ride in this big $100,000 stakes race, was like, I was just so much in awe of all these jocks in the jocks room and everything. And I think it was like 7 furlongs. Yeah, it was like a 7 furlong race. And, you know, it's funny, Christina, how you can remember all those races, you know. And I mean, I just wanted to like kind of keep my horse in a good position and give him every opportunity to win. And, you know, if he ran a good race, okay, but, you know, we were just kind of there, just, you know, I think we were just there. And, you know, he broke really sharp and kind of settled in, and it was really amazing how this, like, a 14-horse field, because you don't really ride with that many horses in a field every day or every race. So I was really concentrating on, you know, keeping a straight course, knowing what's going on around me, and you know, the mind thing again, you know, all the way up the backside, you know, staying out of trouble, you know, keeping everybody else out of trouble, knowing what's under me. And kind of when my horse switched to his left lead on the turn, he kind of picked up the bridle and started running a little bit. I was like, oh, cool, you know, well, I'm going to pass some horses here. So we started passing horses, and out of the turn, we started passing horses. Next thing I know, I look up, and I probably got 8 or 10 of the 15 in front of me in a line across the track. And I got a horse that's up underneath me running like crazy. And I'm like, oh, my gosh. And I remember, you know, I kind of ducked to the inside a little bit. And then I kind of moved to the outside. And, I mean, I just did not see a hole. Those guys rode really tight back then. I mean, they were just right across the track. And I said, heck with it. I grabbed the right rein and made a right-hand turn. I mean, like I was just going to the outside. I took him to the outside. And when he saw daylight, this little colt dropped his head, and he found another gear. And as we were coming to the wire, I didn't know if I was going to win it, but I was going to, you know, it was going to be close. And I remember looking over to my left, to the inside, and there was a line of horses across, probably 4 or 5 of us, I think Sandy Hawley. And I looked right into Chris McCarron's face, and he was looking right at me as we're crossing the wire, and I saw him go, oh, shit. As we crossed the finish line, I was like, cool. I didn't know it was Chris at the time, you know, but I was like, maybe I did get up to win. And sure enough, they put the number up, and he'd win by probably a head. And I think he'd beat a horse called French Legionnaire. I think that's who Chris McCarron was on. And so we come back, and, you know, there was me, the trainer, the groom, and what's the guy? What's there? There was a movie star. I'll think of it. He played, I'll think of it. But that was the only 4 of us in the winner's circle. So we got our picture taken, and it was really cool. I got back to Jock's room, and all the riders were there to greet me and everything, and they were making fun and rubbing my head, and, you know, big Jock from Kentucky come and take all the money. So that was a thrilling race. And, you know, and then that was a little colt I rode in the 1984 Kentucky Derby.
So you just mentioned you had 14 horses up against you in that race.
Yeah.
And so then you had many more horses up against you in the Kentucky Derby.
Yeah, I think that was before they limited the field to 20. And I think there was 22 or 23 in the Derby that year. And, you know, that was quite an experience itself, you know, with being only the second woman to ever ride in the Derby.
Exactly.
I can't remember when Diane Crump was the first one, you know. So it was kind of neat because Diane was there, and so we did a lot of media stuff, and, you know, it was a big media buzz, you know, with a woman riding the Derby again and all that. So that was a lot of fun and helped me learn to deal with the media and, you know, how to conduct yourself and everything. And and, you know, by then it's kind of like you almost have to treat it like any other race, except, you know, it's not. But once you get on the track and you get to warming your horse up, then, you know, it's really, really pretty cool. And, you know, like every jock will tell you, when you're walking through the tunnel, you know, and they start playing My Old Kentucky Home, and you've got, like, you know, 150,000 people singing My Old Kentucky Home, it's pretty amazing. I mean, it's just an awesome feeling. You know, you feel like the spotlight and everything is on you, and this is, like, your moment. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so it's a lot of fun, you know. And then you just, you know, you go out and you do your job. You know, I remember sitting in the gate, and, you know, it just seemed like we sat there forever till they got the horses loaded and, you know, before the start was off. And you know, horse broke good, found position. Up the backside, you know, we just started picking up. We were back in the back a little bit, and we kind of started picking up a few horses here and there. I think my main thing was that I was just going to try to, you know, finish as close as I could. And, you know, if we were good enough, you always think that you have a shot. But, you know, we just try to do the best placing that we could. And I remember coming around the turn, and, you know, that's when the front runners start backing up, and the horses that come from off the pace start making their run. So you start getting, you know, 22 horses in this little, within a 16th of a mile. It got really tight. You know, I knew it started getting really tight. And my horse was up. He was doing a little bit of running, and I remember looking up in front of me, and there's a hole. And it's, like I said, it's that split second. I see the hole, and I look over right beside me, and that jock beside me looked at me, and we both saw the same hole. And it was a matter of who got to it first. So I asked my horse, and he asked his. I got to the hole, and he had to stand up and check his horse. So he ended out the back. So I get through the hole, and then after we turn, you know, past the quarter pole, I remember coming down the lane. And before I went to ride the race, I talked to Don Brumfield, you know, who's a legend in Kentucky. And I said, Don, what can you tell me about riding the Derby? And he's old country boy, and he says, well, he said, let me tell you about the wall. I said, the wall? He said, just remember, when the wall comes, he said, just keep riding. Put your head down, keep riding. And that was all he said. I was like, the wall. You know, so I'm thinking, okay, so as an athlete, you know, they hit the wall, and you got to kind of keep pushing through. But I'm thinking, wow, you know, I must, you know, I hope I don't get tired, you know. But as we were coming down the lane, and it kind of opened up a little bit, I remember the crowd started cheering. You know, that's when the crowd starts going wild. And it was kind of like this, it was kind of like a force that you run into. Like it just kind of lifted you up a little bit. And I remember picking my head up, and even my horse kind of picked his head up a little bit, you know, about, like, what was that? And I remember thinking, oh, my gosh, that was the wall, you know. And what it was like a sound barrier, you know, where the crowd just gets so loud. And as I was, you just felt this, like, whoosh, you know. And it was like, wow. So I put my head down and started, you know, whooping on my horse a little bit. And you know, I think we finished 11th out of 22, so we beat half the field. And I remember standing up going, wow, that was amazing. It was just the most amazing thing. So there's this, like, sound barrier that you hit a rider and a horse as you're heading down the stretch when the crowd gets so loud.
Wow, that's amazing what you just described to us, PJ. You've allowed our listeners to just experience the Derby. That's fantastic. And not only were you the second woman ever to ride in the Derby, you were actually the first woman ever to ride in the Preakness.
Yeah. I think that was 85, matter of fact. The very next year, I was riding a little horse that was doing really well, and, you know, the trainer decided to run him in the Preakness Stakes. He didn't run in the Derby, but they felt that the mile and 3/16 in the Preakness was, you know, was his distance. And he'd been running good. We'd won a couple races on him and everything. And, you know, he was close, I think, in a couple little stakes there at Turfway and maybe Churchill, or one at Churchill. And, you know, so he put him in the Preakness, and he asked me if I wanted to ride him. And it's like, well, yeah. So that was a lot of fun, too. You know, Pimlico is such a fun place to be in the Preakness. And, you know, they just really do it upright. And, you know, their hospitality and everything is just so much fun. And, you know, of course, the media buzz there again, being the first. So, you know, I guess that was, you know, that was pretty cool. You know, I can stick a feather in my cap. You know, there'll never be another first. And, you know, this little horse, I think if he'd have had a route race, a mile and 16th race underneath his belt, he would have run really well, because, you know, he was right there till, you know, like inside the eighth pole. And then he just faltered, you know, and I think he finished fifth. Out of 10 or something, but, you know, it was a good showing, it was a good race and everything, and, you know, so that was a lot of fun, too.
What a memory. That actually wasn't even your best year. In 1990, you had your highest number of victories in that one year, according to Equibase, 175, and the following year, you earned more in 1991 than in any other single existing year. What do you remember of those years?
You know, that's, I think, I don't know if that's when they went over the Turfway, and, you know, Turfway got to be a pretty good meet in the winters, you know, and that was, you know, the winter meet at Turfway Park. You know, I wasn't racing against, you know, the likes of Pat Day and Don Brumfield and, you know, some of those really top riders, you know, like at Keelan and Churchill. So Turfway is what I called my bread and butter meet. And then, you know, I really did well there. I know I had a good spring and fall meet at Churchill. I was like fourth leading rider at Churchill, the one meet. And then I'd win like, I don't know, six or eight races at Keeneland. I mean, for a rider to win that many races at Keeneland, you know, that's a pretty good meet too. So it was just one of those years where, you know, the opportunities were coming. You know, again, the more you win, the more you ride, the more you ride, the more you win type thing, you know. And like I said, sometimes you just feel like you get in that zone and you get on horses that just run their eyeballs out for you. And you're like, wow, this is really cool. Am I that good? And you just get into this mode to where you're nice and relaxed and business is great. And, you know, and usually it's, you know, it's not about the money. It's just about, you know, being able to be on the best horse and getting the job done. And, you know, and I think I matured as a rider, you know, making better moves, smarter moves, learning the trade. I mean, it takes a while to become a top elite athlete in any sport, I think. And, you know, same said with, you know, riders. You know, some riders come from obscurity and you're like, wow, where's he been? Well, he's been there all along. He's just, you know, finally getting the opportunities. And I think that helped a lot. I started getting more opportunities riding for, you know, some better outfits, riding better horses, and, you know, proving myself again.
Of course. And confidence is a huge key in that part of it. And you have to win to win. So you have to be ready to perform at your best when those opportunities are given to you, and you did so much so. You successful at Churchill, at every single Kentucky track, and all across the country, as is obvious by your record. You were actually the leading woman by number of wins in the history of thoroughbred racing for quite some time, until that number was surpassed by Julie Crone and Rosemary Holmeister. But looking back, did you ever think you would be that successful?
You know, that's the amazing thing is that, I don't know, you know, I guess I didn't go into it to be a star. I didn't go into it. I just loved what I did. I loved my job. I didn't, you know, I tell people I've never worked a day in my life because I've loved what I've been doing. It's not work. I loved getting up in the morning and walking around with the sun coming up, galloping a horse around the racetrack, you know, and listening to his breath every stride, you know, as they're going around, you know, and getting into that zone with the horses, just you and the horse out there galloping around, and all you can hear is the clippity-clop of their feet, and, you know, it's just the most amazing feeling. And to be able to get up and do that every morning, you know, so even today, I'm like a really early morning. I wish I could sleep till 6-7 o'clock in the morning. You know, I can't sleep anywhere past 5:30. I've gotten to where I got 5:30, but anything past that, it doesn't matter if it's a weekend or anything. I can't sleep late in the morning. So I'm a morning person, and that was, you know, all those years, you know, being on the racetrack and getting up early, and, you know, it's the best time of day. You know, it's just wonderful, and you get the smells of the stable and, you know, some of the liniments and, you know, coffee. You know, you go to this stable and there's coffee, and, you know, it's just great. And you just walk around in the fresh air all morning long and, you know, get paid to get on horses. It's a great life, great job.
Jockey PJ Cooksey joining me on Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka on the Horse Racing Radio Network. PJ, I own the book, The Horse God Built, written by Lawrence Scanlon. The untold story of Secretariat is a description he writes about you. He follows you to the track before morning gallop, and just your energy just seeps through that book there in that segment. And your love for just galloping a horse in the morning. Not necessarily, wasn't describing winning a race. It was, you were galloping a horse in the morning.
Yeah. I haven't read that book. I'll have to read that, Christine. I'll have to, you know, look that one up. I didn't get a chance to read that one, but yeah, you know, like I said, it's not a job. What a privilege it was. And then, you know, I galloped horses. One winter I left, and I was just, you know, sometimes you just get to the point where you're burnt out, and I knew I was burnt out. I needed a break from winter racing at Turfway Park or Latonia, and I got the opportunity, and I went to Florida, and I galloped horses for Woody Stevens. And I was in the barn when Woody had Swale, when Swale was a 2-year-old. And he had another chestnut colt called Devil's Bag. So there was Devil's Bag, who was winning all the, you know, mile races, you know, seven furlongs, middle distance races. And then there was Swale. Swale was just a gangly two-year-old when I arrived in probably early December, you know, end of November. And I remember, you know, galloping horses for Woody was just great because, you know, he just let the horse do what they want to do. Let him, you know, he was the old school, let them train themselves, you know. And if it was a horse that he didn't want to run off or go fast, he would put big exercise boy on him. Otherwise, you know, I just let him cruise around there. But I remember watching Devil's Bag, and he was all the talk, the Derby horse, this and that and everything. But then there was this black colt in the shed row, and I just saw him go from a gangly, all-legged two-year-old to this big, robust, strong, confident horse that was, like, really coming to himself. And I remember when I got back to Kentucky after the winter, galloping down there for Woody, a friend of mine, he was a writer, and he interviewed me. He said, "Hey, you just spent the, you know, winter with Woody Stevens in his stable. What, you know, what do you think about Devil's Bag?" And he quoted me saying, "Swale will be Woody's big horse on Derby Day." Wow. And sure enough, you know, Swale win the race, and so that was pretty cool. It was neat, you know. It was really neat. There's such a difference in the horses, you know, and I it's so much like people too, you know, that champions, you know, just have this aura and this air about them and this confidence and this, you know, I can do anything and I'm all that, but not so arrogant that they're, you know, that you don't want to be around them. And that's the same thing with these thoroughbreds, is they're just, they're so majestic and so, there's just words that's hard to describe. I mean, and that's what I love about being on these animals, because each of them has their own individual personality. Each of them has their own little quirks, you know, that, you know, this one might do that and this one might do that. And, you know, some of them play too hard and, you know, you kind of got to be ready for all that, you know, especially galloping horse and everything and riding even. And that's what's fun, is figuring them out and them kind of figuring you out. And then you just form this bond, you know. That's just a really neat thing, and you just look forward to getting on certain horses, you know. I mean, I was the first one, you know, if I rode a big strong colt that really needed manhandling, you know, if that's what I could say, like, you know, he really needed, like, picked up and kind of really busted in the butt to make him run, you know, I'd give that horse a couple opportunities for me to try to get him to run, you know, according to my style of riding. Sure. And when I couldn't get him, and I could feel like I'm not getting everything out of him, he's not giving it to me because he knows I'm not making him, and I would tell the trainer, I'd get off and say, you know what, this colt needs a really strong-handed male jockey on him because I'm just not getting everything out of him, you know. And I think the trainers, they would appreciate that, you know. But then I was the first one to go to the barn and say, I want to ride that little crazy filly, because I would get along with all the little crazy fillies. Because I'd just talk to them and soothe them and scratch them on the neck and let them know that, hey, let's just go out and have fun and enjoy ourselves, you know. So I really liked getting on fillies that really kind of needed some soft touch and everything. And I think that was kind of my my forte was, you know, silly fillies, if you want to call them that.
Well, PJ, you are certainly a thoroughbred among people. Your description earlier perfectly describes yourself. I had the opportunity to be with you at Kentucky Downs during one of the events there with your Horses and Hope group, and I was just so impressed and just so in awe of everything that you do. And I'm watching the clock here, where time is flying by, so I want to touch on that briefly. So fast forward 10 years from 1990, 1991, those great years you had during your career. You told the doctors something was wrong. And all jockeys, we can tell how heavy we are almost to the exact pound just by the feel of our skin. So you knew something wasn't right. PJ, take it from there.
Yes, about two. Yeah, you're right. You know, as fine-tuned athletes, which jockeys are, you know, we get on the scale, on and off the scale, you know, 20 times a day, and we can tell our weight within six 8 ounces, you know, on whether we gain or lose weight and everything. And you just kind of know how, you know, you make a fist, you feel a little water and everything. So, you know, I was never one to have to reduce or anything, but, you know, you just know what your weight is and everything. And I just knew that, I don't know, something just didn't feel right with one of my breasts. And after, you know, and I'll say it, you know, I didn't have to get my safety vest adjusted. I just pulled one off the rack and put it on like the guys, you know. So when I felt a little something, I said, huh, that's not right. Well, so I went, they sent me to do a mammogram. Well, of course, when you're that small, you can't get anything in the mammogram thing. So, you know, of course, that didn't come out very well. And so about a year, or probably about 6 months later, you know, they said, just keep an eye on it. Well, I knew, knowing my body so well, I knew something wasn't right. And I felt a lump in my breast. And I went to the doctor. I said, something's not right. You know, it hasn't been there before, and it's not right. We got to do so. So then they did the biopsy, and I was diagnosed with stage 1 breast cancer. And I had a mastectomy and reconstructive surgery and, you know, had all that done and, you know, became another form of survivor and became a cancer survivor. And I think all those years riding races and it, being in a male-dominated sport really, you know, really kind of set me up for probably the biggest fight of my life.
What is so remarkable, for sure, that was your biggest accomplishment. And what's so remarkable is that you went through all of that and you came back.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I wasn't ready to quit. You know, it was just kind of a, you know, kind of a bump in the road. I had to take a little time off. And, you know, once I felt like I was, you know, strong enough and good enough again, then, you know, I came back to riding because, you know, I wasn't going to let cancer, you know, stop me from doing what I love to do. And, you know, came back and rode, was still riding until I think 2003 when I went down to spill at Keeneland and broke both my legs. Mm-hmm. And then that kind of, that hurt.
Yeah.
But, and then came back and, you know, I didn't want to stop my career laying in the dirt at Keeneland either. So I think I was off about 13 months with 2 broken legs, broke my femur and my tibia fibula on the other leg. And came back and rode, I think, about 4 months or so. But I'd had a rod in my leg, and that rod was giving me a lot of pain. So I thought, well, you know, maybe that's, you know, it's best that I retired. And it's not what I wanted to do, but I wasn't sure that was, you know, the answer because I felt like I couldn't ride at 110% with the rod in my leg. So I retired in 2004. And, still miss it to this day. People say, well, you still miss it? Yes, absolutely. There's no bigger thrill riding, you know, 1,200 pounds of horse flesh. And, you know, the thrill of making the right moves and finding the holes and outsmarting your fellow rider and getting to the wire first. I mean, there's just no greater thrill.
It's quite remarkable. We only have a few more minutes, 2 more minutes here. I want to quickly tell everyone that Frank Anderson, a photographer for the Lexington Herald Leader, actually won an Eclipse Award for the photograph of that spill at Keeneland in which you broke both of your legs. A loose horse was galloping straight towards your unconscious body lying there on the track. And to anyone who looks at that picture would think that it ended disastrously, but you survived that as well. It's so remarkable what you've done, PJ. It really is.
Yeah, that was kind of, Frank Anderson and I are really good friends, you know, and he said he saw that loose horse coming around, and he said he grabbed his camera and he started taking pictures. And as I was laying on the ground with, you know, both my legs broke, the EMTs had already gotten to me. And they were, you know, tending to me. And next thing I hear, they're like, you know, duck, everybody get out of the way, duck. And all of a sudden I look up and there's this horse like jumping over me. I'm like, what the heck's going on here? I thought the race was over. It was really confusing. But, yeah, I was so tickled for Frank because he was, you know, probably at the, you know, latter part of his, you know, photography career. And, I mean, you know, for him to win an Eclipse on that, it was pretty cool. So, yeah, but that's just, you know, kind of part of the game. And, you know, you just kind of move on.
Yeah, you say it as if it's so easy, and PJ, you have just such determination and strength. It's really remarkable. Unfortunately, we have reached the end of this hour. It has absolutely flown by. PJ, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Christina. And, you know, come to the races, have fun, enjoy the horses.
Got it. You got it. If you missed any portion of tonight's show, you can check out the podcast on our website,
horseracingradio.net and Horse Racing Radio Network on iTunes. Be sure to join me next Tuesday at 6 o'clock Eastern Time with another edition of Jock Talk presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka. What a show. What a show, Lee. Our producer, Lee Delapina. Really amazing, the story of PJ Cooksey. Such an inspiration. I'm in awe. For our producer, Lee Delapina, I'm Christina McManigal. Thank you for listening.